at the tunnel and is now in the possession of the Army.
Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed the exact same spot the whole time. They're out far, I can say that.
Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. All right, Lisa, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular
disc. Well, the thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I saw it.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like
this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange day indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello. This edition of Strange Days Indeed, number 462, comes to you from my old mom's house in Peterborough, about 90 minutes from Toronto. She broke a couple of ribs recently, and I've been helping out now that she's back home. This time on the program, commentator and editorialist Dave Perlot, our space observer Michael J. Woods, pilot, UFO researcher, and author Don Ledger, and taking us home, Albert Lemberg.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Perlot.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list entitled Abduction Explanations. And the original poster has pretty well covered most all the rational explanations that have been given to us regarding alien abductions. Out-of-body experiences, past lives, memory interference, sleep disorders due to suppressed sexual abuse or other means, and shadow people caused by seizure disorder-like brain overactivity. Other list members contributed a few more, like mental instability and stigmata. All of those posting to the UFO updates list concur on one thing. Even the full litany of rational explanations cannot cover all alien abductions, because there is one thing standing in the way of all of it. Any case involving multiple witnesses or multiple experiencers blows the rational explanations out of the water. Oh, wait a second. Of course, there is one explanation that has been bandied about off and on over the decades that could account for multiple witnesses and multiple abductions. Mass hypnosis. Actually, that so-called rational explanation has always been one of my very favorites, because it has never been explained as to who might be doing the hypnotizing of the unwashed masses, or even why. And that, of course, brings me to my underlying question regarding alien abduction. Why would a race of aliens journey millions of light years to our tiny little ball of mud just to pick up a few strays, do some experiments on them, and in some cases return them to the flock? This kind of thing is unthinkable. And it's unthinkable because of the arrogance of our species. We're an intelligent life form, and nobody would ever do such a thing to an intelligent life form. Really? We think nothing of capturing bottlenose dolphins and making them perform tricks, conduct experiments on them, or use them in warfare. And it has been proven from some of our experiments that those creatures are one of the most intelligent creatures residing in the oceans. Anyone can see that we are technologically advanced and have to realize that we will fight back and not allow them to treat us like cattle. Oh? Tell that to Cortez and the conquistadors as they destroyed great cities and technology of the Aztecs, or to old world invaders that treated Aboriginal inhabitants of North America as heathens, barbarians, and destroyed settlements that were quite technologically superior in dealing with such mundane things as human waste or even simple bathing. Better yet, tell that to the slave traders that attacked villages in Africa so they could ply their trade, ignoring the simple beauty and art history of the people they were enslaving. It is a waste of time and resources for a technologically advanced society to study the habits of an inferior species. Now we're pulling at straws with that one. How many billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of hours have been spent on studying insect behavior on this planet? And surely nobody is going to argue that insects are not inferior to humans. You see, the only way to deny the possibility of abduction of inhabitants of this planet by an intelligence from beyond the boundaries of this planet is to deny their existence. And that's nothing new, by the way. More and more archaeological digs have been proving that North, Central, and South America have been visited on many occasions by people from across the ocean, long before Cortez or Columbus showed up. The simplest thing to do in that instance was simply to deny they existed. The leaders and governments of the day gathered up the evidence, such as helmets, shields, swords, and spears, and simply hid them away or tried to destroy them to the best of their ability. But eventually, the people from across the oceans managed to find their way safely across and could come and go as they pleased. Eventually, those same people gathered up inhabitants from these continents against their will and brought them back to the old world. They were put on display. They were toyed with. They were experimented on, and on very rare occasions, returned to their native land. So, taking the opinion that the majority of the populace of this planet believes that other life exists in this universe besides ourselves, it falls within the natural realm of reason to assume that maybe, just maybe, they might actually stumble across us on this new world. So why would they take some of the inhabitants of this planet? One, they can, and there is nothing we can do to stop them from doing it. Two, to learn more about us. Three, because we are obviously an inferior species and have no rights. Four, to use us to improve the quality of their lives, whether we like it or not. I really would like to believe that nobody has ever been taken by force away from this planet, and that we're dealing with crackpots and people who suffer from ailments that confuse them. But because I do believe that we have been visited and are being visited, I also have to believe that it is highly possible that people are being taken against their will. But that's just my take.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
And a damn fine take it is too, Dave Furlong, as usual. There would be some interesting comments and observations from the likes of John Belez and Katarina Wilson and Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs.
Oh, yeah, no question. It's like they say, there's all of these rational explanations that we put out there, but they don't cover everyone. The reality is, history has proven so many, many, many times that these things happen. We do it ourselves. So why the hell should we be surprised if somebody else does it to us?
I know the reality is that abductions are going on, as do, as I said earlier, tens of thousands of, not hundreds of thousands of people.
Not everybody who claims they have been abducted have actually been abducted. I'll grant that. But there are people definitely in no way, shape, or form have been abducted, have been taken away. Richard Hall was the one who pointed it out on the list, that some of these people you talk to, they would love to believe that they are crazy, because the alternative is that it actually happened to them. Like, please, please, please prove to me this is all in my mind. This is all something that I have conjured up, because I don't want to believe that it really did happen. And before the benefit of having examined some of the people or having talked to some of the people who've actually been abducted, you sort of go, yeah, you know, it sounds so crazy. How can it be real? And then when you talk to some of these people or look at some of the various pieces of evidence that are out there, you've got to go, damn, yeah, I was wrong in the way that I was originally thinking.
Physical marks left on the bodies of abductees is certainly something that makes you go, hmm.
Exactly. What are you going to do? Say, oh, I'm sorry, those are self-inflicted. Yeah?
Yeah.
Right.
I trust we find out about that too one day, although again, I'm not holding my breath.
No, I'm not either. I look at it this way. One of the very first notifications that we were visited in the early times was like back in 900 AD. And then when we really started getting stuff was back around 1492. So you're talking a span of 500 years. Roswell, for example, could be Leif Erikson visiting the planet for all we know. So, we could be hundreds of years away from Chris Columbus showing up on the shores going, hey, hi.
Yep, being visited, as David Cherniak says in his documentary, by beings who are millions, if not billions, in advance of us and our technology.
Yeah, it's like some of the people are saying, well, it can't be, it's too expensive. Da, 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 da. Hello. Yeah.
Yeah. Dave Furlott, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you next time.
Oh, for sure.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm the urban spaceman, baby. I've got speed. I've got everything I need.
Periodically, mostly when things are interesting space-wise, my former co-host on this program, Michael J. Woods, joins us. Lots of stuff going on as far as space is concerned lately. And joining us, once again, is our space correspondent, Michael J. Woods. Good day, Mike.
Good day, Errol. How are you doing?
Good. And you yourself in person?
I'm as fine as can be expected for a middle-aged dweeb like myself.
Oh, and how does the middle-aged dweeb feel about what's going on in space?
Well, frankly, we could go 2 hours just to talk about the stuff in the conventional space exploration world.
Uh-huh.
And then probably another 2 hours for what's going on in the unconventional space exploration world.
Oh, there's a lot of that going on, too.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you. And it's been a while since we chatted, so should we tend to wander off the path, well, do slap me one upside the head, at least verbally.
Okay.
I think I'd like to start with my favorite planet, the good old red planet. Mars, once again in the news because of the work of the Phoenix Lander. That's the major robot that was sent down to Mars to look for water. Now, you and I have discussed many times over the years how I have always had a problem with the aging of Mars, that the conventional science says that Mars has been in its current state for up to 10 million years since it got walloped by something possibly the size of Pluto. That's the current conventional thought because of the differences in the elevations of the ground surfaces on the northern and southern halves of the planet. The northern half of Mars is something like 2.5 kilometers lower than the southern half, on a line that runs at a just slightly off kilter from the equator. I've said repeatedly, I don't buy that. I'm very much thinking that Graham Hancock has a more accurate estimate in that Mars, at its catastrophe, lost its atmosphere and water less than 15,000 years ago. The reason I believe that is because of the lack of erosion on the water features on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
We've all seen all the photos, vividly etched lakes and rivers and riverbeds and runoff streams. And they're just not going to last millions of years on a planet that has planetary year-long dust storms like Mars does. So, having said all of that, I never thought it was much of a question. By looking at the physical features that we've already seen with orbital surveyors of Mars, there was never any question in my mind that Mars once had water. All that Phoenix has done has confirmed it. They've dug up some ice, and I know you talked about this on the last podcast, but we'll go back to this. Because recently, they found sign of perchlorates. And I'm probably mispronouncing that. Everybody out there, have a good laugh. I never could pronounce long words. Perchlorates are a known element. They're a binding form of salt. We find it on Earth naturally in some high alkaline areas. More importantly, we're more familiar with it because it's used as a basis for fireworks and rocket fuels. And as a contaminant, it's not good news. And it has been found after rocket launches in the atmosphere, in the water, blah, blah, blah. And it's not good for you. Now, when the Mars Phoenix lander scooped up some soil, cooked it in its Easy Bake oven that it carried with it, it discovered traces of perchlorates, which are basically a combination of a chlorine and one other substance combined. Immediately then, the science whizzes, especially on the internet, declared that this was a contaminant from the Phoenix lander's rocket engine. Only problem is, it didn't use fuel that has perchlorates in it. So they're now back to the belief that this is a natural occurring chemical. As soon as that was announced, then it was, whoops, this is contradictory to life. Wrong again. And we've got bacteria here on Earth that eats perchlorates. So that doesn't look to be the cause of it. What is the cause of it? Who knows? But it is something that occurs naturally in high alkaloid soil here on Earth. There are bacteria that actually feed on it. So this does not eliminate the possibility of life on Mars. And in a related story, kind of snuck in under the wire, I didn't actually notice it at the time, but as of the end of July, NASA extended Phoenix's mission more than a month, 40 days. And all that adds is $2 million to the price tag for the mission, which was at $457 million anyway. So, you know, a bargain. You get an extra 40 days of exploration for $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the idea here is that if they find ice or water on Mars, well, it really increases the possibility of us being able to set up a permanent habitat there and actually make our gateway to the solar system that NASA would like to do. Where there's water, humans can live. Just that simple. Doesn't matter what form it is. We can melt the stuff. We know how. We'll send them up with extra big lighters. Doesn't matter. The other two are friendly little rovers that are starting to slide into winter hibernation. And I've got to tell you that as much as I love manned exploration of space, you got to love what these little robots are doing.
Very much so, yeah.
My goodness me. Oh, let's cook this up. I love the concept of their Easy Bake Oven and how they're looking for water. So they scoop up a sample of this soil and expose a vein of ice. Then they drop their soil sample into the little filter screen that will drop it then into the Easy Bake Oven to cook off. It allows them to analyze the chemicals in the sample. I just love the fact that the first sample they dropped in was so moist and so clean, mud-like, they had to shake it for 2 days to get it to fall through the screen. I wonder if there's water in there. Well, something's making it into mud. Work it out, you know. Wonderful stuff.
But I notice in the image that both you and I have been playing with, so that we can adjust the colors to the way they're supposed to be, in the scoop mark that is in that image, there are strips of white or shapes of white, which
yep.
can only be ice or snow.
Yep, and because of the speed with which it sublimates off the surface, which means basically evaporates in the lack of oxygen and atmospheric pressure, there it is. It's just what it is and can't be said, oh, it could be a color problem and all that. But we should get, and I think we should mention, color problems. First off, this may be a surprise to some, a shout out to my old friend Nick up at York U. Him and I have long since agreed that we don't agree on anything politically, and so we only talk about UFOs. and related subjects. And Nick on the updates list posted a fascinating double linkage. One showed you a beautiful, clear color photo of the color calibration disc attached at various places on Phoenix so that they could adjust the cameras and get correct color. Then Nick provided a link to the NASA website that shows one of the first panoramics shot by the Phoenix. Beautiful thing. Shows the Martian plane. It shows the sky. Shows about a quarter, half of the lander. And as Nick has properly pointed out, if you blow that photo up using anything, Photoshop, whatever, and find yourself one of those calibration discs, what clearly was shown in a release by NASA of the calibration discs that showed three white circles opposite a blue circle, a yellow circle, and a green circle. These were used to calibrate the cameras. Well, when you take a look at the photos that NASA is sending out and releasing, Marlin Space Photography.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it is. Marlin's got them. He's the man, isn't he?
They've been following the tradition of tweaking Mars pictures to make sure that it all looks like a red planet.
Well, it's amazing how when you focus in on one of those color calibration discs put on the lander, how the three white, the blue, the yellow, and the green on the photo that I've downloaded from NASA clearly shows those discs as purple, almost orange, and a lime green. Now, those are not the colors of that calibration chart. Clearly not, because, I mean, NASA's released a beautiful, glossy manufacturer's photo. And these colors do not correspond. Now, frankly, my talent lies with words, not with visual art. And so I was not able to manipulate the colors with my Photoshop to get those calibration discs to the color they should be. Got them close. When I did, the soil was a lot less red and a lot more brown.
Yep.
And the sky was a hell of a sight less pink and an awful lot more blue.
Exactly.
Exactly. There's a problem. We know that while Mars's atmospheric pressure isn't as low as it was originally stated in the 12 millibar range, which is bugger all, and it's much higher than that, we also know through lander photos, both Opportunity and Spirit, the two rovers and the Phoenix, we know that there are, on occasion, clouds on Mars. We know that because we photographed them. That leads me to indicate there might be a little bit more water vapor in the air than NASA's ever been willing to admit, because our skies are blue through sunlight shining through the blue spectrum of the water vapor in the air. And that's pretty much going to be the same reason why there's any kind of blue in the sky of Mars. Is NASA manipulating the color of their pictures? I don't think there's any question. If your calibration disc isn't the right color, you're doing something wrong. Just that simple.
Oops.
I'm sorry. If Red Skelton steps on stage and his hair is blonde, your problem's with your TV set, okay?
Right.
Fix the color. Well, we've got brown and blue skies on a planet that's supposed to be red and pink, so, gee. No, NASA's not manipulating images. We know they don't do things like that.
No, not at all. Which didn't stop the techies at NASA when the first pictures from the first lander were beamed down to Earth. The techies ran around and tweaked all the color TV monitors to make sure that everything was red.
This isn't even a question, really. Does NASA manipulate the images it gets from space? Yeah, obviously. And for me, the classic example was what's known in UFO circles as the cat box photo of the face on Mars. The first released photograph of the face on the Cydonia Plains, made by the reconnaissance craft, the first one since Viking to shoot the face. And didn't they release that without doing about half of the things that are required just to make it a normal image? So that looked even less like a face?
Yep.
They did. No questions about it. A week later, they released one that was corrected, and it looked a hell of a lot more like a face than the so-called cat box photo. So, we know they manipulate photos. Why would a space agency do things repeatedly that would tend to take away from the possibility of life beyond Earth? we go back to our late 50s Brookings Institute report again that says you hide all signs of any alien artifacts or any discovery of other intelligence out there, because we would be in the situation of a cargo cult being introduced to a more advanced technology and fall by the wayside. That was always the Brookings Institute justification. Looks like NASA's still taking it to heart. Now, if we move out a little further from Mars, and why not, since we've booted Mars around enough for one day, we go out and we confirm that one of the moons, I think it's a Saturn, Titan, is got lakes. Got big lakes. Got lakes so big that the one that they found, they called it Ontario Lacus. Lake Ontario. And the reason being is that it's approximately the same size of a 2,500 square miles.
Mm-hmm.
But, hey, it's nice to know that we're there. Anyway, this was thanks to the Cassini probe, which has been floating around Saturn now for about 3 to 5 years.
Didn't Richard Hoagland suggest that they would find water there when they got there?
I think everybody suggested that one. It's well worth mentioning that one of the many Robert A. Heinlein science fiction stories, one of the few that's ever been made into a movie, was The Puppet Masters. He wrote this before the invasion of the Body Snatchers, and it tells the tales of an invasion of Earth by a parasitic slug that takes control of a human that it makes contact with. They originated on Titan in the book. So back in the early 50s, Heinlein was looking at the moons of Saturn and saying, this one looks like a good possibility for life. So Titan has always sort of been there because of its size and whatnot. Anyway, they now know that the hydrocarbons collect in black lakes with surfaces that are as smooth as glass. I love that. It's almost poetry. And there may be as many as 100 lakes and seas in the North Pole region of Titan alone. It's liquid ethane, and it confirms the long-held notion that Titan's lakes were filled with methane and ethane, and evidently that's what we got. So
it's not water, then.
Oh, it's not water. There are many ways to make hydrocarbons. Only one of them involves the decomposition of organic material. This ain't it. But it's interesting to note now that we know of two planets in the solar system that have fluid. There's a small clique of scientists that also believe that Titan has an underground ocean, a below-surface ocean of hydrocarbons. I don't know what we could do it for, and if we could process them to make fuel, well, so long $1.25 a liter gas, eh? Although I must admit, the drive to Titan to fill up would be a bit of a...
Yeah, you'd probably run out of juice on the way back, too.
Yeah, you know. We're still staying with the space program, but we're going to take a step sideways now. Probably one of the biggest kerfuffles in the last month or so in the UFO world has been the disclosure by former NASA astronaut Edgar Mitchell that he knows for a fact we've been visited on the planets. The UFO phenomena is real, and it's been covered up by governments for years, half a century or more. And he says, in fact, that there's been three alien races in contact with the government for approximately 50-odd years now. Well, didn't that fire up the old firestorm there? Because Edgar Mitchell was the sixth man to walk on the moon and one of only 12 who's ever managed that feat. Okay, now this is something that I believe, just that simple. I believe we have been visited. I believe there are UFOs, and I believe the governments are hiding what they do or don't know. But almost as interesting as his disclosures were how the media reported them. Now, ABC in the U.S. on their website, they take the tack that space travel changes the traveler. That the people who have actually gone beyond the borders of Earth end up changed spiritually, philosophically. Their perceptions are changed. The implication being in their article is that, Edgar, like the admitted and known difficulties that Buzz Aldrin had when he returned from his moon mission, it's almost like space traveler crazy. Like if you travel in space, you're going to go a little weird. That was definitely the underlying hint of their coverage of Mitchell.
Yep.
But Do you know by any chance Keith Basterfield, co-director of the Australian UFO Research Network?
I know of him. He's been on the list.
Well, you've got to love this one. According to him, author of several books on UFO sightings in Australia, he believes Dr. Mitchell may have damaged the work of serious scientific researchers into UFOs due to the former astronaut's broad claims and his inability to source what he's presenting as fact.
I read that. I thought, yeah, right.
Okay.
Okay.
So, some armchair warrior. And as a writer, I feel no need to pay any respect to anyone else who is also a writer. So some armchair writer in Australia is, in essence, claiming his work is more important to the UFO field than Mitchell's disclosure because he won't name sources. Well, now, if I recall the interview, and please correct me where I'm wrong, as I recall, he talked about being briefed on this back in the 50s and 60s. Do you remember who was at a meeting you attended in 1959, 1963, 1965?
What meeting?
Precisely. I'm having a hard time remembering what I had for lunch yesterday. So, excuse me for not, he doesn't name the sources he's getting this information from. Yeah, well, it was a while ago. On the other hand, just as Mr. Basterfield claiming that Mitchell's disclosure has done the UFO community harm, and how could you possibly harm the reputation of the UFO community and researchers? These are the people who argued for 6 months over whether it was a pelican spotted at Mount Rainier. Okay? So, I'm sorry. Mitchell's comments are doing harm to UFO researchers? The single biggest danger to UFO researchers is their own narrow, blinkered, scientifically illiterate approach to this whole subject. Spending weeks on weeks slagging each other over whether it was a gray feather or green feather, you know, whether it's a beautiful green field or a dusty gray field, it don't matter. UFO researchers don't need enemies. We're our own worst enemies. And Mitchell's comments can only add a certain intelligent aura, a certain respectability to this research, not taken away from it. Now, on the other side, a fervent, and I agree with him, defender of Dr. Mitchell is another member of the UFO updates community, Greg Boone. And I kind of like it. At one point, he challenges people to step out in the alleyway if you're going to question Dr. Mitchell's character. Couldn't have put it better than myself.
A man after your own mission.
Absolutely. Because I personally prefer to convince through reasoned argument and logic. But if that won't work, a slap upside the head is okay by me, too. Interesting to note, too, that I have a couple of quibbles with Mr. Boone. He, as so many others in the UFO field, like to slam the media for being controlled press. Talks about how it was a conspiracy theory when we predicted the housing market and credit crisis. Well, frankly, nobody did, at least anywhere that I read. If it was a conspiracy theory, it was a conspiracy theory of one. And then, of course, I always love when people call me a prostitute. So, other than that, I'll ignore his slams at the media. Hey, it's an easy target. Why not? You know, yeah. They don't fight back very hard. But I'm sorry, the bottom line here is real simple. Dr. Edgar Mitchell has more degrees than I've had hot meals. He is one of a dozen men who has walked on the moon. He holds the record for the longest walk on the moon by a human being. In everything that he has said in his interviews since this disclosure, he has shown no indications of having slipped any of his cogs in his golden years. And further to that, Mitchell's interest in the areas outside of mainstream science aren't new. Mitchell conducted an experiment on ESP with NASA's approval during the Apollo 14 mission. So this is not him suddenly being changed by his voyage to the moon and becoming cosmic consciousness. This man has had an interest in outside of the mainstream science areas when he absolutely embodied the right stuff, the pure essence of American scientific progress. So it's not a new position for him. His mental facilities seem to be a lot sharper than mine, which I admit won't take an awful lot. So I think we have yet another brick in the disclosure wall. Just that simple.
Yeah.
Now, we also have that guy who was claiming commander of the space fleet, and I'm not going to mention him by name because his website demands $500 if we mention him by name. Not going to happen. But this gentleman, who got done out of his NASA pension after 30 years with NASA, came out totally backing up Mitchell's statements and went further in that he claims that during one space shuttle mission, he watched a minute and change of a transmission between the shuttle cargo bay and NASA.
Are we talking Clark McClellan here, Mike?
I believe we are.
This man is a shyster.
Yes, I thought he was, too.
Yeah.
Like I say, when I see a guy whose website claims that you cannot mention the story, his name, or anything else without a payment of $500, well, you see, unlike a lot of people, I actually work in the mainstream media. And for those of you paranoids out there, after 22 years, no one has ever told me to not or to do a story. I've never been ordered to do a story, and I've never been told not to do one. That includes the days when I was producing the news for Breakfast Television, which is the number one morning show in Canada. Okay? So, sorry, like to join in your little paranoid fantasies about a dictated, controlled, mainstream corporate media, but frankly, my station's owned by the number one cable provider in this country, and nobody tells us what can or cannot go into a newscast. Sorry about that. In the mainstream media, sorry, we won't pay you for your story. So when you put up a, you have to pay me $500 to mention this, frankly, I know, one, I'm looking at a manipulator. Just a money-making grab, as far as I'm concerned. And two, he won't make the mainstream media, because for the most part, we try not to pay for news. Doesn't say that we don't pay for news, but we try not to. We really try.
Yeah, I wouldn't believe anything that comes out of Clark McClellan. He fabricates a lot of stuff.
Makes it up.
He's another Bob Exler, if you remember the name Bob Exler, in connection with CARP.
Oh, yes.
And the CARP-Guardian affair a decade ago. Then
yes, I remember that well, Errol. It was my introduction to you and to the UFO world.
Well, there you go. And Clark McClellan is of the same ilk.
Wonderful. Just love him out there. Now, Mr. Basterfield in Australia, you might have some problems with guys like these, but I wouldn't have an awful lot of problems with an Edgar Mitchell disclosure. You know what I mean? You want to whine about something harming UFO community and research efforts, there it is. It's the hucksters. It's the con men. It's the chronic liars. It's the people whose critical judgment is absolutely absent. For me, as much as I enjoy it as entertainment, a late night coast to coast, the radio program, enjoyable program. But the problem is, there's absolutely no critical evaluation of any claim that's ever made there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just accepted. A case of your mind being so open, your brains fall right out on your shoes.
When you have 5 hours a night of radio to fill.
Big patch of time.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. My show does 3 hours live a day on TV, and it's a strain. It's a strain. There's no question about it. But a little critical judgment would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we've thrown bricks and bombs left, right, and up the center, time for us to shift and go into nice guy mode. Because this is my first opportunity to comment since David Cherniak's UFOs, The Secret History aired on the History Channel. I, for one, am disappointed at the low level of reaction to it. Now, I'm tempering my disappointment with the knowledge that it has only aired on the History Channel in Canada. I know your American and international listeners are chomping at the bit and would love to know what the heck we're talking about, because you and I have been raving about this documentary for about 3 months now since we got a preview. And aren't we fancy, eh?
Aren't we?
Aren't we? We're so important. Sometimes I scare myself. But if you are outside of Canada, if you are getting cranky with us for mentioning this, and you sitting in the dark, unenlightened by this latest UFO documentary, well, it's simple. Get off your backside. If you're in Britain, start rattling the BBC's cage. If you live in the U.S., you want to be hitting PBS pretty hard. Get them to air this. This is a documentary, A, of a quality that is airworthy anywhere. There is no network standards, no channel standards so high, this documentary can't meet them. And I have now shown it to people from UFO fanatics to those with a mild interest, to those who wouldn't know a UFO if it landed on their head. And to a person, I have had to endure 90 minutes of utter silence as they sit there captivated. David's done a brilliant job. He's used every tool of the documentary maker's toolkit to put this documentary together. The glaring difference that two people commented, and both made the same comments, I found it stunning. One, it was a refreshing change from the "this is the hit-them-over-the-head school of documentary making." It was balanced, showing both sides of the equation. And unlike documentaries by that Oscar winner Michael Moore, David didn't feel the need to lie or misrepresent or fake the things that he was talking about. The documents are there. These are facts that were being discussed, not these little fictions that other well-known documentary maker seems to get away with constantly. So to American, European, Australian viewers, I suggest you get off your asses if you want to see the best documentary on UFOs ever made, and start rattling your national broadcaster to purchase it so that you may know what we're talking about.
All in One Films is the name of David Cherniak's production company. For you listeners who want to do something about getting it run in your neighborhood, All in One Films is online, and all the information is there at the All in One Films website.
I strongly recommend that if you can't get your national broadcaster or whomever to air this, well, then I would suggest you pray that it gets released on a for-sale private DVD, because it truly is a brilliant piece of work. It isn't a brilliant UFO documentary. It's a brilliant documentary, period.
And beautiful.
Oh, just...
it's gorgeous.
I've now watched it 3 times at my own home, plus the screening you and I had, and I am just constantly amazed at the dedication to detail, the use of archival footage and music, the fact that it's not treated as deathly serious and totally devoid of any humor. Because, I mean, let's face it, you get a bunch of UFO people together, you gotta laugh, because, you know, there's a few of them that are definitely going to be bending the boundaries of what we all consider normal. I thoroughly recommend it, and I hope the rest of you get the opportunity to enjoy it. Now, having said all that, the thing that I am disappointed by is the lack of reaction. This is a UFO documentary that ends with a major caution and a big arrow pointing to where the UFO field should be going. And let's face facts, the work of Bud Hopkins, the work of Dr. David Jacob, which is highlighted in this, points us to an area that's almost become the elephant in the room. While we're arguing on whether or not Edgar Mitchell's disclosure helps or hinders UFO research, while we argue about pelicans and who said what about who and what email, we're getting more and more evidence that not only are we being visited, we've been visited for a long time. They're doing genetic experiments and the takeover is in effect. Now, that seems to be what the evidence indicates, but remember, like UFOs themselves, tons of evidence, no proof. Well, the elephant in the room of ufology is the hybrid issue, is the genetic experimentation. And, I mean, it has been a consistent theme of the abductee story. And, frankly, why we're bothering with some of the nonsensical personal ad hominem attacks that constantly distracts from the real issue. We're supposed to be UFO researchers looking for the proof of UFO visitation here. One of the highest probability avenues of that proof would be abductees, and particularly the phantom pregnancies and the hybrid issue. Now, this is a real, you know, we do DNA research ourselves now. We can tell what's human DNA and what isn't. This is the area that we should be focused on, not on each other's delicate little personalities.
Some of that work has been done in Australia on the pubic hair that was found wrapped around the penis of a victim of sexual assault by a female on him. There were two different types of DNA in there, which really confounded the analyst.
Yeah, as it should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I'm talking about. We will once again, though, those of us in the research community, we will continue to argue on how many grays can dance on the head of a pin, ignoring the fact that the pin is being driven into the fabric of our own society. So it's always discouraging in the UFO community for that, that we seem to be more interested in slagging each other than getting to actual answers. And so I don't know what the answer is to that one, my friend.
No, neither do I, Michael J. Woods. Mike, thank you. As always, pithy, P-I-T-H-Y. Please excuse my speech impediment, which is being worked on and, with any luck, should be resolved by 2012 and the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah, by the way, what are you doing December 23rd, 2012?
I will have my head between my knees and repeating after everybody else, Our Father.
Yeah, I'd probably be up at the Apocalypse Now, Armageddon, tired of waiting for it, lodge myself just to watch that one play
yeah,
out.
And I neglected to add, of course, kissing my tushy goodbye.
Well, now, you see, a lot of people are concerned because the Mayan long count calendar ends December 23rd, 2012. I'm not, because I'm not Mayan.
You're not?
I'm not concerned about it because I'm not Mayan, so...
Oh, that's right. You have a lot of Celtic blood in you.
I'm a druid, you know. So I intend to be curled up with a bottle of good scotch on that day.
A great idea.
Ach, I'm thinking.
Hen, so on that note, Nolishtaya.
And Pugmahan.
Nice driveway. We will talk to you next time.
Errol, always a pleasure. You take care of yourself now.
And you too, Michael J. Woods. Thank you, sir.
You're more than welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Don't need a phone at all. We've got a thing about some old red-eyed love. We've got a wave in the air. Red-eyed love.
Don Ledger, who's a regular contributor to this program, has been a very busy man of late. Done a couple of conferences and sort of was peripherally involved with the Stephenville radar reports down there in Texas. And he joins us on the line from his home in Nova Scotia. Hey, Don, how are you doing?
Pretty good, Errol. How are you?
Oh, struggling along. San Jose and Shag Harbor, huh?
Yeah, kind of busy there for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Things tend to bunch up, I notice, when you're doing this stuff. And the only thing was, San Jose was easy because I was pretty much just ferried there and I'd do my thing and then I'd come back. But this Shag Harbor thing, I'd set up the speakers line up and I was pretty much running that day, so it kept me pretty busy and always updating the website and so on, you know, for the conference. Conference itself did better than break even. It wasn't a huge crowd showed up, but that was mostly, we think, because we couldn't seem to get the local press to get online a couple of weeks beforehand rather than, oh, they all showed up in big bunches on Friday, the very first day of this thing.
Of course.
And that didn't do us any good because people aren't going to say, oh, well, let's not do that this weekend. Now let's go down to Shag Harbor. They're not going to do that, you know. So too much, too late.
Yeah. People know about the websites now.
Yeah.
So they'll be looking for the listing for the second annual around this time next year.
Yeah, we'll be setting it up fairly early, and we've got some interested speakers who want to come over and attend it. There is interest amongst the society that runs Shag Harbor, UFO Incident Society, to have another one next year, even though they figure it's pretty much like smashing themselves on the foot with a sledgehammer getting involved in this, because it's basically six or seven women who run the society, and they were pretty busy through the whole thing. You know, they're going flat out pretty much the whole time. They're used to that, you know, raising money for the volunteer fire department.
Mm-hmm.
Shag Harbor's not a very big community. It's only about 800 people, and the people in the community themselves have been there doing that, you know, ever since the book came out about 8 years ago, Dark Object, which incidentally now is out of print. At least that's what I've been told. I thought my other book, Maritime UFO Files, was out of print, too, until I got a royalty check and found out that it had been selling for something like 8 months before that, but they neglected to tell me about this.
Oh, my.
And I'm getting on these radio shows and telling people, you know, well, no, Maritime UFO Files is no longer in print. And in fact, it was. So it was probably burning sales there, you know.
So how was the attendance at Shag Harbor?
Maybe around 50 people. Wasn't big. Fortunately, and the reason it drew so much Canadian press was the fact that the federal government gave them $2,000 to hold this festival.
The federal government gave an organization $2,000 toward hosting a UFO festival?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, but that's nothing compared to what they give out to these other festivals that go around the country.
I'm thinking the federal government and UFOs and a festival,
yeah,
and money.
Yeah. But they're looking at it from the federal government's point of view as per their federal member, the MP for that area. But the festival is meant to encourage more tourism in the area because it's a fishery area and the fishery is declining. And they're looking for other avenues of revenue. But you're right in your assumption that this would be sort of a red flag around for particularly the media. And I know the National Post did a story on it and also La Presse in Montreal. Because of that. Actually, I didn't find out until I did an interview with the reporter at La Presse that that's what had gotten him interested in calling me and asking me about the Shag Harbor Festival. And then he mentioned to me about the $2,000, and that's the first I'd heard of it. Actually, it had been announced along with a bunch of other things in a press release, and they just picked it out of there. And he said he was happy to see that because it gave him an excuse for the first time to write about UFOs in La Presse. And still be able to attach it to a legitimate story. So that's what he did.
La Presse is a French language newspaper in Quebec.
In Quebec, yeah. And it's one of the largest newspapers in Canada, actually. And it's always being quoted by other papers in the country, and the CBC and the ATV and CTV and so on, the networks.
Who were the speakers at Shag Harbor?
This year we had to try to set it up to keep the travel expense down because we didn't know how it was going to go. Anyway, Stan agreed to come down from Fredericton. Stan's always a draw. And that was indicated by the number of people that expressed interest. And we had Carl Feint up from Delaware to talk about water UFOs. He's the expert in that area in these days. And two documentary filmmakers, which anybody that's in this business knows about, which is Mike McDonald. He probably did one of the best Shag Harbor documentaries early on, back before Chris and I even got the book out. And then Paul Kimball, everybody knows him. And they both presented their documentaries. Mike McDonald's Intruders, about the abduction phenomena. Very well done, I might add. And, of course, Paul Kimball presented the 10 best UFO cases. And they both went over really well. And, then, of course, there was the usual suspects, me and Chris Stiles. We each did a talk. Chris started the day off, and I finished it off. So six speakers spread across from 9 o'clock in the morning till about 6:30 at night. And then we did a panel and asked questions of the panel and so on. And it worked out. I would have been pleased with more people, but it worked out as well as it did. The people who were there, strangely enough, are only probably about half of the 50 that showed up were from the area. Some other people were from New York, New Hampshire, a couple that was over from England and so on. The international people got the word. What we have to do is somehow get a set up so people can get right from the airport to here if that's indeed why they're coming in. Because you just don't bump into Shag Harbor accidentally. You got to go hunting for it. But that's okay, because it's a scenic drive through there, and I think the people like it.
Yeah, Nova Scotia is really pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a motel nearby?
If you go about 20 miles out of Shag Harbor, you can get motels, but there's none right in Shag Harbor. They're all bread and breakfast. So that's something we have to address. That's going to have to be part of the package when we put it out so people know exactly where to go. The museum had 60 people go through on Friday morning within 2 hours.
Wow.
But these people did not show up at the conference, and that's what I don't understand, at least some of them anyway. Not to mention the press showing up as well. These were just regular tourists who came into the museum, and some of them probably came around to meet some of the speakers that were going to be there and knew they'd be around the museum. So CBC and French CBC and CTV was there, and some smaller outfits. Everybody showed up at the thing, but unfortunately they showed up on Friday morning and they did their pieces that night, and it was too late for even Saturday, really, you know. So
it's a small conference, and with any luck it will build over the years.
I'm hoping it will. If they can stay with it, if they can afford to do this each year, they're trying to get what the province wants to call an interpretation center built, which will be a small museum. And the small museum they have now is just donated space on the side of a house. It's not very big. It's still, a lot of people go through it. tiny little museum had 1,600 people go through there in 3.5 months last year. So far this year, tourism's down a bit, but doesn't seem to be affecting them too much. I think they've had, 300 or 400 people go through there. So there's interest in the topic and in the area, you know, and because it is kind of a quirky little area, it's not your regular little spot, you know. And people coming to the conference are going to have a different experience than when they go to the big city conference, where they're pretty much cooped up in a hotel. I'm kind of hoping for that reason alone it'll be a little different. I don't expect this to turn out like Roswell, but I mean, if they got a small percentage of what happens in Roswell, it would do the area a great deal of good.
Good luck to you folk out there in Nova Scotia next year, and from a small conference to a little larger one. And now let's move on to a great big honking conference that happened in San Jose, California.
That was probably one of the best conferences I had attended, probably because the subject matter was near and dear to my heart, which is pilots and UFO encounters. And this year, MUFON, that was their international conference, you know, in San Jose, had decided to target the interest area of NARCAP, National Aviation Reporting Center for Aerial Phenomena.
You're the Canadian...
One of two, yeah. Actually, myself and Gavin McLeod.
Oh, out in B.C., yeah.
Out in B.C., yeah.
Yeah.
Gavin and I actually met up again. We hadn't seen each other in about 10 years or so. Ted Rowe, CEO, and Dick Haynes, chief scientist for NARCAP, myself, Larry Limke, Leslie Keene, she's part of NARCAP, we all... presented at the conference. Brad Sparks was there, but he wasn't presenting this year, but he was there as an NARCAP representative for the meeting. We did have a NARCAP meeting right there in the hotel during one of the lull periods, the evenings after we were finished, which was Saturday evening. 13 or 14 of us were there. Major General Wilfred de Brouwer from Belgium.
The man who was in charge of the fighters who chased the Belgian Triangle.
Yeah, well, he was in charge of the investigation of the whole thing for about 4 years while he was in the Belgian Air Force. Very interesting fellow, very nice fellow to chat with, and as usual, a lot of work gets done and a lot of information gets moved around after the fact during some of the dinners that they have. One interesting thing that happened there, Dick Haynes received an award for Investigator of the Year for the O'Hare sighting from MUFON, and when he went up to receive his award, he asked how many people in the audience were academics. And quite a few people stood up, and there were three or four at my table. I asked them what their persuasions were. A couple of them were engineers. One guy, a very interesting fellow, was an engineer, but I didn't realize this until later when we got talking around down at the hotel watering hole. One fellow was a professor at some university. I overheard him talking to somebody else, and it was kind of hard to talk because there was a speaker, Leslie Keene, so he couldn't actually have a conversation around the table. But I did ask them, you know, why they had come up for this thing, and they said, well, they heard that it was going to be a couple of scientists presenting, and there were more than one, and been persuaded by friends to come, and so they did. Actually, one of the fellows, his name was Chuck Maudlin, had been a radar specialist for the U.S. Navy, and then he retired from the Navy and he went to work for the Lawrence Livermore Labs in San Jose, Silicon Valley. It's right in the center of it there. He had some very interesting stuff that he could tell us that wasn't classified. And so I tied him up with Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell, the two guys that were doing the investigation on the radar, that got the radar data from an FOIA, the FAA, in other words.
For Stephenville, huh?
Stephenville, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll get into a little later
on. Yes, yeah.
So Chuck Maudlin, myself, Brad Sparks, and Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell had a really good meeting out in the hallway the next morning. Holland found out his expertise in that area, and he had a great deal of expertise with radar, particularly military radar, which only some of it, which he could speak about because a lot of it's classified. But it's impressive to know that military radar in the United States is above and beyond what the civilian radar is for air traffic control, the accuracy of it. Well, of course, it would have to be. When you're dealing with missiles chasing your airplane, or you're firing a missile that's going at an airplane, it has to be something that's right down to a couple of feet. It can't be something then it's off by a half a mile as regular radar can be, air traffic control radar, which is kind of scary when you figure it out. But there was that component to it, and my expertise in the radar areas as it applies to pilots and forth, I don't have the chops that Brad Sparks and Robert Powell and Glenn Schultz would have, or this modeling fellow. It was very interesting to find out what was going on there. So, Wilfred de Brouwer, he presented on the Belgian sighting. It was very interesting. I was surprised at the number of people they interviewed. You know, many, many hundreds of people were interviewed who reported this thing, and he explained what happened with the aircraft and so on. They'd done a detailed analysis of that famous Belgium triangle, the three lights on the bottom, and they were able to enhance and see that there was actually a top side to this thing. It was on a slight angle, and you can see the top of it in the enhancement. Various photographic experts, and not just people in Belgium, but other people from other countries who had agreed that this definitely was a solid object. I noticed in the San Francisco Chronicle article that the reporter that was in the audience, if he was there, said, oh yeah, definitely there was white sponges on the screen. Apparently didn't pick up on any of the information he was given, done by scientists, I might add, but he's a reporter and he knows better. I read the whole article, and it was the most childish article I think I've ever read, written in a newspaper. And I considered sending a letter to the editor or to this guy, and then I thought, why am I wasting my time with this guy? It was basically the worst write-up. It was obviously somebody that spent maybe 20 minutes at the conference and went back and wrote a story about something they knew absolutely nothing about and had picked up nothing from what these speakers were talking about, because Larry Lemke had been up talking about the object at Chicago O'Hare that had gone up through the clouds and made the cookie cutter hole right through 4,000 feet of overcast and 4,000 feet and left a hole that lasted some 8 or 9 seconds, which is impossible. He went into the science of what must have happened. He's a scientist. He works at NASA. And what must have happened in order for the hole to stay well-defined. You just can't do that through cloud. You suck something up through the cloud, it's going to create a vacuum that's going to pull the cloud right into that hole as you're going up through. This thing punched a hole through it, and you could see blue sky above, which was incredible.
Really incredible.
Which the FAA blamed on weather phenomena and runway landing.
Name me a day when that's ever happened before.
Yeah, everything was above Gate 17 on Concord C, and then you go and look at the layout for Chicago here and see where the runways are. Yeah, the FAA, the disaster, looking for a place to happen. They have no weather expertise whatsoever. That's the NOAA, as from what I understand, the United States. But they're spousing on weather phenomena. They don't know anything about weather phenomena at all. But anyway, that was a joke. But the conference in general was at a very good level. They were keeping the woo-woo factor down to a low hum. It was all about unidentified aerial phenomena as it relates to aircraft and the danger that it could be, and the attempts to get the federal government to recognize this. The American federal government, once they do, a few others will probably follow. Even that silly Condyne report that was put out back a couple of years ago did recognize that these things are nothing to be toyed with. You shouldn't be chasing them with airplanes or getting close to them.
And that was just one guy who issued that report, not a team of enthusiastic scientists.
Yes, that's exactly it. And I've seen that posted in different places where the team of scientists from the MOD had determined that there was nothing to the phenomenon. There was no team. There was one guy, apparently he was a pilot, who did this all on his own. He wasn't even allowed to interview witnesses to the cases that he did have, you know. I don't understand that. It's like telling a police detective, well, sure, he solved the murder, but you're not allowed to interview the witnesses.
No.
That's silly. That's the way that one came across.
How about this whole Stephenville thing? What have you been into behind the scenes?
Well, and there's a couple of things I'd like to mention here. I'm not sure how it happened. Sometimes you just get sucked into these things early on, right? Now, here I am in Nova Scotia. Texas is about 3,800 to 4,000 miles away from me. I got interested because there was such a flap going on. One of your subscribers, I'm sure, Joel Carpenter, who's been around for some years, on the Stephenville sighting, and I wasn't aware of this myself because I don't have an air chart of the area, he posted a copy, and it's available on your site now. You can go there and find that. A copy of the sectional air chart that private pilots use, and the scale is 1 in 500,000. And it's just below the Dallas-Fort Worth area where the radar is, and there's also a naval air base there. And just below that is Stephenville, slightly to the southwest. Off to the right, it's already circled on the chart, this big white area about 60 nautical miles apart, which is about 66 miles in diameter, which is the protected area around the Bush Ranch in Crawford, and that's his home. The edge of that is only about 20 to 25 miles away from Stephenville. Now, the thing of it is, it's just east of Stephenville, about 25 miles to the edge of that zone. The very center of that zone is a 6-nautical-mile circle that is absolutely prohibitive. You're not allowed to fly in there at all. You're not allowed to fly in the other area, which is 66 miles in diameter, if the president is at the ranch. Otherwise, at any other time, you can fly there, providing you have a transponder on board your aircraft and your flight plan through there. A lot of pilots, apparently, something like 400 or 500 pilots, have been busted so far for flying through there, not realizing they're right in the zone. But in any event, the fact of the matter is that the witness testimony says that, for the most part, these objects were flying from that area over near the president's ranch towards Stephenville. And then there's other reports of them going back eastward again. Now, we've got reports of F-16s being in the area. First, they were denied that there were any F-16s there. Then the Air Force, a couple of weeks later, said, yeah, they did. They had 10 or 12 of them out there. At least one witness, anyway, claimed that they saw two F-16s in afterburners heading towards the east, which would have taken them right towards the Crawford Ranch. Regardless of what these things were, if they're an anomaly or an unknown of any description, and the Air Force finds out about it, they're going to try and intercept them if they're flying over into the restricted area. Bush wasn't there on that particular day. It was a Tuesday. In the meantime, there's any number of radar sites around the area, just ringing the area. I thought that was rather interesting that they would naturally have to. They wouldn't have any choice. They would have to have aircraft interdicting if there was unknown objects, uncorrelated targets, going towards the Bush Ranch. Look what happens in Washington, D.C. when there's aircraft flying into that area that aren't supposed to be in that zone. It's a restricted area as well. There's something like 39 of them around the United States. I found this very interesting. I've written originally in UFO Updates a small article there concerning that, which we'll come back to in a minute. And then I expanded on that, and Frank Warren carried it on his site, and then I expanded on it further and put it out in Fate magazine, which came out March the 1st. So pretty much anything you see about this interdiction or aircraft chasing or possibility of some anomalies or uncorrelated targets going towards the Bush Ranch probably started with myself and triggered by Joel Carpenter's chart. Then, of course, later on, Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell got involved. I think it was Glenn Schultz that sent in the FOIA for the information to the FAA looking for information about radar hits that night, and they sent him 2 hours of raw skin paints, which is not the computer filtered stuff that the air traffic controller sees. It's what comes up on primary radar, and there was a few million hits on there, but of course they were all just constant hits of commercial aircraft in the area and so on. But there were anomalies on there that haven't been explained yet.
Does that show the transponder codes from each aircraft?
No, there is the raw transponder code information is embedded in that, but it doesn't show up until it goes through the filter to the computer, to the radar screen that the air traffic controllers are looking at.
Uh-huh.
So they're seeing filtered information when they see it, and it's sort of cleaned up. Sometimes there's aberrations with the returns that they're getting. They jitter around a bit because we are talking about radar that isn't as good as what the Air Force is using. Now, an interesting little side issue to this was the fact that when I wrote to the subject in UFO Updates, which you posted, another guy by the name of Booth, who runs UFO Casebook, picked up on this and put it on his site without asking me about it or asking you for that matter. And one of your regular contributors, The Norm, had run across this and he mentioned it. And I went and looked and sure enough it was there. And at that point, both you and I got involved and because he was plagiarizing the stuff. And he put it up on his site.
Without giving anybody any credit.
No, right. He just put it up there. So then what happens? 6 months later or so after the fact, all of a sudden this guy comes out with another report on his site saying he had had information that he had written an article on Crawford Ranch and the UFOs in Stephenville and about F-16s chasing UFOs and so on over towards Stephenville, which in fact he hadn't done, and that he'd been contacted by the Secret Service and told to take it down, or somebody like that, the Secret Service or the CIA, and told it to take it down off his site. So he tried to make a big deal out of this, which was untrue. The people who confronted him were you and I, made him take it down, and then you kicked him off updates.
I'm still not getting any checks for my work with the Secret Service or the FBI or the CIA.
On several occasions now in different areas on the list, this story of his has come up from the woo-woo crowd, and even Mike Sala had fallen into that trap too and was intrigued by it. And I posted to several people. I haven't sent out the big one yet, but I sent out several lists updating on what really happened in that case and that. nobody had told him to take it down. It wasn't Secret Service, unless I'm the Secret Service or you're the Secret Service or wherever. But it was just plain nonsense. He was making the story up. And that's about what that site is worth.
Let's go back to the radar now.
Yeah.
And what's being combed out of that morass of information?
Again, for me, it's general information because I don't have the expertise that Glenn Schultz, Robert Powell, Brad Sparks, and so on have. But essentially, there was an anomaly picked up on the site going where everybody says it was going, towards the Crawford Ranch. But what's puzzling about it is that the thing seems to slow down to zero, backtracks on itself, and then speeds off again. It speeds upwards of 500 miles an hour back towards the Crawford Ranch. And that might be some kind of a radar glitch. They're not sure. And they're trying to determine if that's the case or not. But there is an anomaly on there. Still being studied to determine if, in fact, this is the case. Neither Glenn Schultz or Robert Powell or Brad Sparks saying definitively that this thing is definitely a real anomaly. It could possibly be an airliner, although there doesn't seem to be any transponder code coming off that. There's always the case. You can never actually nail it down. It's like trying to nail jello to the wall in the UFO field, trying to nail any of this stuff down. But there seems to be, not fully conclusive, but almost conclusive proof that there was some kind of an anomaly in the area until they sorted out, which maybe they never will, I don't know. But that's where it stands right now. Ken Cherry and his MUFON investigators had done a detailed investigation down there of many people, and there were several hundred witnesses to this.
They put out a sizable report, too.
Yeah, and Glenn was there. He presented, too.
In San Jose?
San Jose, at the San Jose conference, and it was a very reasoned report on the investigations. So that's out there as well. He's a no-nonsense type. He doesn't buy into everything that comes down the pipe. Now, I guess he's just as probably curious as everybody else is as what's going to come from the radar data.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been nice to have the logs from Dallas-Fort Worth and some other places and the audio tapes. A lot of the stuff is recorded, plus the filtered returns as well. They're probably gone now. They record what's going on in the tower all of the time. They're held for many, many years. But radar data itself, unless it's in contention, somebody's brought it up or questioned it or something, it's usually deleted after 30 days.
Well, that's odd because out at Pearson International, outside Toronto, they burn every day to a CD or a DVD. It's there in perpetuity.
Well, that's good to know. The audio tracks?
It's everything.
I would think, because I find it kind of strange that after 30 days, and a lot of this is going to hard drive nowadays, that they would do away with anything that might come back to bite them later on. You know, sometimes an incident happens that's not really known about until much later on. There might be a problem between an air traffic controller and a pilot or whatever. So why not keep them on disk? It's 365 disks a year. You can probably get the whole day's worth of data on a Blu-ray or whatever, you know. It's
just, oh, easily, yeah.
Very easily, yeah. And with big airports like Pearson, O'Hare, San Francisco, L.A., New York, Heathrow, those are monster airports. The traffic that's going in and out of them in the run of a day just scary. Newark, Boston, and I can attest to those because I've been through them all, but it boggles my mind that they would destroy that, and it's there, why not save it? I wish I had more detail on the radar, but I can't speak with any degree of expertise in that area, and I don't want to shoot my mouth off and claim things that might not be true.
This is enough to whet the listener's appetite to go look for more detail for themselves, I think.
Sure, yeah.
Don Ledger, thank you, sir.
Oh, glad to be here, Errol. I always enjoy doing this show.
Hey, and enjoy what's left of summer, and we'll talk to you next time.
Well, thanks very much, and you have a good summer, too.
Bye, Don.
See you. Thank you for having me on.
Enterprise, Alabama is where Alfred Lemberg lives, and every couple of programs we head down there, ask Alfred Lemberg what he thought of what preceded him in the program. Alfred Lemberg, what did you think about what preceded you in this?
Well, Errol, I think it was another program of singular significance. No, it really was. They all are. In a podcast milieu and universe where there's simple sniping and carping and generally unprogressive behavior by persons all around, I think it's refreshing to hear this, where Everybody has an axe to grind, sure, but they're upfront about it, and they're willing to take criticism on same. So it doesn't get really any better than that.
You have some specifics in mind, I hope?
Aside from the fact that it really was a program of singular significance, I was enthralled with the chilling tales of Dave Frelott regarding the abduction kerfuffle that seems to be going on the Internet now. And I thought we got some pretty interesting realizations from Don Ledger that really need to be going into or not, and are not being gone into enough. And then lastly, we actually visited Mars. I felt I was there with our resident druid, Michael Woods.
Druid? That's funny.
I see him in my mind with a long white beard, and he's wearing a cowl, and he's chopping mistletoe from the tops of trees. I didn't think that was far off the mark in light of the fact that he's apparently of Celtic origin.
Aye. Right enough. That's where his family comes from.
That explains his ability to almost see me despite the fact that I am around the curve.
Yes. Lemberg, yeah, he's around the curve, mostly the left curve.
But back to Dave Frelott now, this kerfuffle that's going on UFO updates regarding that abduction thread that everybody seems to be weighing in on, and I'm seeing almost the point of real foam beginning to fleck. I thought it was a good thing that he point out some of what they're talking about on there, the excuses that are being made, and he brings up one in particular that I think is kind of fascinating, this, and everybody's heard it, that concept of, okay, if you're not misleading or misled, you're mentally ill, and subject to some kind of mass hypnosis. We've heard that over and over again for years. But I wonder, who or what is it that performs this mass hypnosis?
And it certainly brought John Belez out of lurk mode again, huh?
Yeah, he was just hopping and leaping. I expect a little more cogent conversation from John Velez on this subject, too. And I'm glad, for no other reason, it's kind of scared him out of the shadows a little bit. Because, man, we need to hear from that guy.
Yes.
And some of the things that are said with regard to alien interaction. For instance, why would aliens respect us when we don't show respect and really never have? That's kind of my contention. Their argument is that we are too advanced to be molested. Or you have the flip side of that. Or we're too primitive to be bothered with. And, you know, it always kind of tickles me that these folks are seemingly willing to try to have it both ways when it can't be had both ways, or any way for that matter. Other questions were asked. How does humanity use its intelligence with regard to other species on our own planet? And have that read other peoples for that matter. The argument that a superior intelligence would not waste time or investigate an inferior species, you really have to give up an incredulous, oh, really? When we seem to be spending billions doing just that, looking at insects and animals that are allegedly lower than us on the evolutionary scale, when it's really kind of interesting, the animals that we dismiss and talk about are animals that, it's been pointed out by other biologists, are really at the point of being complete and perfect with senses we have either never had or have completely forgotten about. So our arrogance does us shamefully, I think, in that regard. And the other argument that a superior intelligence would of needs show respect for an inferior species because they were superior. And okay, let's bring it back to us. Let's look at ourselves. Do we... You can answer that question any way you want to, positive or negative, but if we don't, what does that say about our superiority? Huh? Have you ever looked at it that way?
I have, on many occasions, and what I find intriguing is, and I think I've mentioned it recently, what I find intriguing is that there is a movement afoot among scientists to call a lot of the primates people. A lot of the primates and a lot of the cetaceans.
I've heard the same thing myself, Errol, and I am not so much excited but gratified that we'd be willing to begin to take that look, because it's pretty obvious to me that we're not and have never really been the only people on this planet.
And it's really unfortunate that we're talking about the kinds of persons, the kinds of civilizations, the kinds of societies that have put themselves so far up against the wall of just trying to maintain themselves that they do have to predate on dolphins, on whales, on apes even. It's really a shame. Dave Frelott brought up another very interesting thing, I thought, when he was talking about denying alien existence as the only option available for denying the abduction by aliens. And this has given the overwhelming evidence to the contrary of abductions of aliens at the start, fleshed out by numerous persons. We don't even have to mention the name Hopkins and Jacobs. The credible persons have looked at this and come up with another genuine enigma. And when you consider that humanity itself is an abductor and always has been an abductor, as Dave Frelott pointed out, how can we begin to expect better treatment from the off-planet other? All in all, I thought Dave brought up some really chilling things and very fruitful and contemplate, I think.
As he always does.
Every week, to be able to come up with something substantive the way he does connotes something that goes beyond interest in this thing. The guy's in deep and considers at that same depth, I think. On to Don Ledger. Again, I have to remark every time we have that guy on, what a joy and a pleasure it is to listen to him speak about a twitchy subject in the manner that he does that makes it not near as twitchy as it probably is and a lot more considerable for that. I just enjoy listening to him speak about this subject in particular.
He's very grounded in his knowledge of both commercial and civil aviation.
True, and he's also into it with a lot more currency than I am. The aviation currency that I'm using, I haven't even involved those brain cells since 1992. I appreciate having him around to keep me up to date in that venue.
And there aren't that many pilots who are interested in this field.
Well, again, being a pilot, most pilots are cued in on staying in the air once having been up there and are loath to practice any behavior that would preclude them from doing that, I think.
That applies to the military, too, huh?
Oh, absolutely. I can think of two situations. Remember during the Mexican UFO kerfuffle, and I brought in my anonymous pro from Dover with regard to side-looking radar and how that stuff works in infrared, and then him, to this day, still being perplexed by those things that he witnessed there on that tape that was going around.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't want his name remotely mentioned with this. And that other fellow I was telling you about, the UH-60 pilot, he and his entire crew had a ufological encounter of such intensity that one of the crew in the back of the aircraft soiled himself. And he doesn't really want to talk about it. This is not the guy that soiled himself. This was just the fellow that was piloting command on the aircraft involved with this thing. And he doesn't want to talk. Again, pilots that don't want to talk about the ufological for obvious reasons. I was interested to hear that Canadian federal government is providing money to the Shag Harbor people to put on their UFO festival.
Kind of blew me away, too.
Yeah, I think that's significant because I can't imagine grant money going to UFOs down here for any reason.
I think it was just through the auspices of the local member of parliament that that money came through. And I don't think anybody up the funding echelon took too hard a look at what they were going to be doing at Shag Harbor.
Well, let's see what they get next year. I'm hoping for the best.
Yeah, me too.
I was glad to hear the report that his conference up there had a significant draw from outside Shag Harbor.
It would have to, because there are not a lot of people who live in Shag Harbor.
Yeah, I guess that kind of tracks some dollars.
Yeah.
But there are people that would just come for the day, I would think, to be part of something that was their natural history. And despite that, Don Ledger made a point of saying that there was a considerable draw from outside. So maybe he thought it was significant, too.
And I think as each year goes by and the word builds, and as people go to shagharbor.com, as they find out about it, each successive year will probably bring more audience.
Well, I hope so, because I think that this is something that is honorably commercial and can do a good turn for people in the community that maybe have been having to endure a lot of ridicule over the years that is really blown up and made to go away with conferences like this and the efforts of people like Don Ledger and tell the real story and what's going on. And I'm very excited to hear that a museum is likely going to be built in Shag Harbor. And I'm reminded of other towns where similar things have occurred, like the town of Roswell, and St. Albans now for the Flatwoods Monster incident, and Fife, Alabama for the kerfuffle that they had going on in their town here in northern Alabama.
And speaking of Roswell, you saw that article on computer-assisted design for the potential new international UFO museum down there, huh?
Yeah, I did. Very compelling. Back to the subject of the commercial aspect of these things, the honorable commercial aspect of these things, that they have a potential for honorableness, that is to say, that they're good, solid consciousness expanders and a good thing for the study of ufology and it getting a broader base of interest from the people not involved. I was amused and had to laugh when he said that his conference managed to keep the woo-woo at a low hum.
Yeah. The New Age people who are interested in UFOs in one form or another, and the tinfoil hat wearers, I think that's what he was referring to.
And again, with all respect to tinfoil hat wearers, because remember, it's those folks that are likely there only because they're not getting significant quality information from where they should be getting it, their societies and their cultures.
Or their drugs aren't that good.
I think it's pretty much demonstrated that if it's not DMT or psilocybin mushrooms, that the drugs are never that good.
Yeah. That's Shag Harbor pretty much covered off, Alfred. Let's head across the continent and south to San Jose, California, and the annual MUFON Symposium that was held there.
Do you know a way to San Jose? And
whoa,
apparently
whoa,
Don,
whoa, whoa,
whoa. Right. And apparently Don discovered the way to San Jose. Oh, but just wasn't that clever as the Dickens.
Oh, wasn't it not?
Anyway, Richard Haynes was down there. Who's the top kick for, I forget?
NARCAP.
NARCAP, that's right.
The National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena.
I was very excited to see that Richard Haynes was included. And Richard Haynes has always been very special to me because he's the fellow that put the stamp on that STS 48 mission that had all of the alleged ice crystals changing direction and changing speed. And Richard Haynes was on a film with Stanton Friedman and Jack Kasher, and they're talking about this, and it was very, very exciting, especially in light of the fact that I've got some of the film that you don't often see on television. And I'm sure other people have it, because I got this in a tape from Stanton Friedman, where he's talking about something else, and he'd put this little mini-documentary on the end of it. And what it is you always hear the discussion about the focus of the camera, and it being focused out to infinity to look outside the cargo bay of the shuttle. You see all of these things at an infinity's focus, and they're moving, and you could look at them, and you could call them ice crystals. But the point is, towards the end of the film, the camera begins to pan down inside the shuttle bay, and the focus of the camera changes before the horizon and the face of the Earth disappears. And all of that stuff, all of those points of light, suddenly go out of focus, indicating that they couldn't have been flecks of ice or little ice particles.
What you're saying is that the ice crystals would be in the foreground, but in actual fact, what was zooming around was way in the background.
That's exactly what I'm saying. At any rate, it was very exciting to hear that Richard Haynes was included, because he's not often included with these things. I was also excited to hear that Major General Wilfred de Brouwer was involved, and this was, of course, the Belgian Triangle top kick investigator that was investigating all of these things, and apparently had investigated for many years, and was able, after all of these years and all of his reputation, to be able to stand up in a crowd of people and say that it was a definite solid object, indicating that it wasn't balloons and gassy pelicans. There was something definitely out there. Mm-hmm. That is to say, a bona fide anomaly.
A bona fide, unidentified flying object.
You betcha. And other things that Don Ledger brought up that was kind of interesting, his distinction about coming up front and saying that most assuredly and most definitely military radar trumps civil radar. And see, if that's true, we have seen UFOs with our civil radar. What UFOs have been seen with that better military radar? We know they're there because of the civil stuff. Consider the military and their radar and what they're seeing.
Well, look at NORAD and the stories of them having fast walkers appear on their giant screens.
Yes, and not only NORAD. My dad used to tell me when he was working for Aerojet that they were regularly getting sightings like you described, fast walkers, with their Aerojet satellites and just writing them off and blowing them away. Well, that's not what we're supposed to be watching. We're supposed to be watching other stuff with these satellites, and they're not designed to see these things that are entering the atmosphere and then leaving the atmosphere. We're just going to ignore them.
Isn't that often the way of it all? Ignore them, they'll go away, and we won't have to deal with them.
Sad but true. Larry Lemke and his study of O'Hare takes something like that, something that was seen by dozens of people, unfortunately not photographed very well, if at all, but dozens of people saw it, and it punched a real hole in the clouds where that just doesn't happen, you know, unless you've got some kind of weird kind of energy that is acting on that cloud. Again, another bona fide anomaly.
Nah, just a weather immersion.
right. The reflecting Venus that's then bounced off gassy chemicals from a flatulent pelican. Yeah, right.
Exactly, and the swamp gas got in there and just held that hole open.
Or fireflies between two sealed panes of glass. Which, oh, by the way, has a vacuum in there. Consider that. That space is vacuumed to preclude any condensation and what have you.
Like the brain of whoever it was that suggested it was fireflies.
Exactly. And the Condyne Report fellow, well, again, that fellow that tries to perform an investigation and he's not allowed to interview the witnesses. What are we doing here? It's insane. More stuff about Stephenville. I was really glad to hear some of the facts that he was able to proffer in his description of that, talking about numerous pilots busted for impinging on either that restricted airspace going out to some 60 miles or the prohibited area, which is 10 miles from center. But the number that he used, 400 or 500 pilots had been busted for impinging on that airspace. Now, for the Stephenville kerfuffle, we have F-15s, allegedly 10 of them, in the area pursuing something. I have to ask the question, who penetrated the restricted airspace? If they can bust 400 or 500 pilots for doing it, they must have gotten the guy chasing him with 10 F-16s, don't you figure?
Or not.
Yeah, really? That's the point, or not.
Yeah.
I was glad to hear Don talk a little bit about the thieves of intellectual property that persons such as himself have to endure and you have to endure. That brings to my mind and reminds me of not only the thieves of intellectual property, but the distorters of intellectual property, the maligners of intellectual property, the deniers of intellectual property. What did we have? We had something out there on radar legitimately flying at air speeds between 0 and 500 miles per hour. What is going on, society? Help me out here, culture. Terrible stuff. Last thing on Don Ledger. He brought up the point about being able, in this new age of data storage, being able to keep data. That why would you do away with something that's going to come back and bite you on the ass later on, as Don pointed out, right?
Yep.
Except that which will bite you on the ass when it comes out later on. That's why you get rid of it. Nothing else makes sense.
Somebody destroyed it without authorization. I don't know what happened to it. It's just it was here somewhere at one time. And
True. I'm reminded of the lost message traffic at Roswell. I'm reminded of the missing accident records for September 1952, where more fighter accidents occurred than had been over the U.S. in peacetime flying ever. What happened to all that data? And why would you want to lose it if it was going to come up later on and bite you on the ass? Except it'll come up later on and bite you on the ass. That can be the only reason why you would get rid of it, it seems to me. How about you?
It seems to me that there is more and more discovery of missing data as it applies to unidentified aerial phenomena than there ever has been. As investigators investigate, lo and behold, this information has disappeared. and without authorization. Well, how the hell does that happen?
Well, I'll tell you, I just don't think it's much of a stretch. I don't think you have to jump very far to a conclusion. I don't think it's unreasonable that you got to be covering something up if the critical data ends up missing. Any other sane individual would start pointing a finger and say, okay, responsible individual, responsible entity, where is this stuff? Produce it now. And they would have to do it under some pretty extreme penalties, I would think.
Or die.
Maybe it comes to that.
Treasonous action.
Yeah, it is treason, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
On to Michael Woods and his conventional space news / unconventional space news. I love that guy. I absolutely love that guy. I love the way he'll go out and he'll stick his neck out and he'll take the unpopular view with regard to Mars being whacked by some kind of object, perhaps the size of Pluto, many millions of years ago, according to our mainstream science. But then being able to reference Graham Hancock, who I have a lot of respect for and regard for myself, down to something less than 15,000 years. That's startling.
It is. It's like, when were the pyramids built?
I think the jury's way out on that, you know, given the work of Robert
Schoch.
That's it. He's done some significant work that I think is just completely bulletproof.
Yep.
And it really doesn't matter how much Zawi Hawass is going to call him one of the pyramidiots when the man is a lettered geologist that makes statements based on real science and facts. You know, I just don't think you can write him off as a pyramidiot. There's just a lot more going on this planet and in space, I think, that we are remotely willing to admit to ourselves. But case in point, the confirmed water and those things that were found in the soil, the percolates, I'm sure I'm blistering the pronunciation myself. Did you notice the little kind of catch in his voice and the disappointment reflected when he reported that his Woods rovers were in their winter hibernation and he wasn't able to say anything about them?
And Lord knows, they've been up there a very long time now.
Well, we got our money's worth on those puppies, I can tell you.
Over and over and over.
And then launching into that kerfuffle regarding color calibration. That's unsettling. That's dispiriting. That really kind of makes you want to look over your shoulder at what is supposed to be a responsible authority on what they're talking about. But why do they change the color of Mars? Can you think of any reason why they would want to do that, that would be benign?
No, none at all.
Especially when any kid with Photoshop can adjust the hues to a point where the color calibration card is correct, and we have now blue skies and brown earth on Mars.
What a surprise.
Yes. And what's up with that old cat box photo that went out of its way to make the face go away on the Face on Mars feature?
And as I've said many times, we have still not addressed the tubes on Mars.
You and I have discussed offline. There are a whole bunch of things that came up once and never came up again. It wasn't enough that we visited Mars as a result of Michael Woods' brilliant explication of same, okay, that we were also able to visit Titan, where life has been forecast since Robert Heinlein, apparently, and we have black lakes of hydrocarbon, smooth as glass on the surface. Underground oceans of same. And that about cleaned up Mr. Woods' conventional space news, and now on to the unconventional space news. We have that real disagreeable and unfortunate treatment of Ed Mitchell regarding his ages old. You were reporting on this in UFO updates back on, I think, 1997, wasn't it?
In October of 1997, if I recall.
But three races observing us now, some kind of involvement, some kind of interaction for over 50 years, and we are being visited, and UFOs are a real entity, but to be dismissed by the media as, oh, well, you have to understand, you know, you get out into space and it makes you a little crazy. Oh, man, they should be taken out and shot for that.
How would they know?
Well, it's safe for them to think that. And I noticed a lot of people down here on our end were saying a similar kind of thing. Am I in arrears, or do I remember Paul Kimball writing a little something on his blog regarding that, you know, Mitchell could perhaps at the beginning of his discredit, reaching for things that weren't there, trying to hang on to a celebrity that was dwindling away from him. It seems like I read something from Paul. And others, is the point that I'm trying to make, and others in the responsible media that essentially said Ed Mitchell was going crazy because he's talking about this stuff. And that's a wrong thing to do.
Yep.
Especially saying that Mitchell harms UFO research, when just the most casual observation shows that it is the, as Mike Woods pointed out, the narrow, the blinkered, the scientifically illiterate who approach the subject of UFOs and that problem in that fashion. That's the real problem, huh? I was glad to hear Mike talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, spend some time talking about how it's reasoning reasonableness first that he's all about and that he would much rather be involved with. But if it comes to it, then if it becomes required, a slap upside the head is not inappropriate.
Yeah.
Then he got to talking about slamming the media and how off the mark some of that was, that he's never been told to write anything, he's never been not told to write anything. And I have to say, with all respect to Michael Woods, he's esteemed in all eternity as far as I'm concerned. The guy can do no wrong. But I have to offer that maybe a person involved, as he is, in the legitimate media is perhaps not the best person to criticize it. This is especially given when he was just a few minutes prior talking about media reporting doing some of the wrong things that they do vis-a-vis Ed Mitchell. Kind of interesting to hear that take on it. And Michael Woods says that he, and didn't say so in so many words, but indicated some discomfiture and some irritation at being labeled a whore for being in that business and speaking what's spoken on his media. I'll tell you, partner, knowingly or unknowingly, aren't we all whores to a degree? Consider, man, if they took my electricity away, hell, if they even took my coffee away, I'd do anything they said. You know, I've heard it said many, many times that each of us, it doesn't matter how erudite and refined we are, each of us is three meals from savagery, and I think that's probably pretty true. It was good to hear Michael Woods talk about David Cherniak and his new film, UFOs and the Politics of Reality. I have just reviewed that thing myself, have just finished up my second time through it, and I have to tell you that it's without a doubt, bar none, the best documentary film on UFOs I have ever seen. Now, I say that indicating that it is not sufficient to say that it's the best documentary film on UFOs ever made. I quickly discovered that this film documentary is a whole different article altogether. They call the kind of cinema that David Cherniak produced cinema truth, or in the French, it's labeled, I think, a little bit more appropriately and better, certainly, is cinema verite. And I'm here to tell you that this is a documentary that has some real shelf life. It will last forever. It's the kind of program that you want to see about UFOs, because he's not trying to convince. He's not trying to persuade. But it remains that he does both of those things to the nines. Still, it's a killer film. You ought to start bugging PBS or the History Channel or the Discovery Channel to try to get it, because David Cherniak does take the facts as they are well known, as they are vetted, and as they are as real as they can be, and he puts them together, takes the ufological facts as well known as they are uncontested, and demonstrates an affair as unsettling as it is enigmatic, as embarrassing as it is shameful. And he does that by being able to demonstrate that UFOs are not ridiculed or dismissed or ignored by the mainstream simply because the sum total of UFOs are the misled, led by the misleading, and inspired by the mentally ill. It just goes a lot further than that, and that
begins to be an excuse that is pretty facile, given the evidentiary categories, including a detailed history covering thousands of years, vetted antique art and photographs depicting UFOs, well-scrutinized and evaluated anecdotal accounts from individuals unknown to one another, and all of this regarding the same incident. Thousands of cases where UFOs have left physical traces. The data are conservatively monumental, simply monumental. You've got to see this film.
I totally agree. It's a documentary that's going to hang around forever, and as has been said many times on this program, it will be handed around when people who want to know, need to know, and are given the doc in order to know.
It's a historical document to see on the subject of UFOs. See it. At any rate, that's all I had, good sir.
Well, thank you, good sir. As always, it is good, sir. We'll talk next time, Alfred. Good job. Thank you.
Looking forward to it, Errol, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
I'll be seeing you next time.
Alfred Lindbergh's website is alienview.net. Don Ledger's is shagharbor.com, spelt either English or American style. Thanks to them both, and to Michael J. Woods and Dave Forlott, and our thanks to you for your continued interest. Till next time, keep your eyes to the skies. Bye.
I descended to a cold white slab that was in some sort of a lab. Black eyes were joined by two tall blind guys. And old Gray said, I'll be okay. Just a few tests to do today. He cut a few.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to SDI@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.